Hello and welcome to the Mystic Cast. We join Jack Stafford, a member of the Aetherius Society, the cosmic religion for the Aquarian Age, as we break down the barriers between religion, science, metaphysics, philosophy, and mysticism, all of which are really only aspects of the self-same quest for truth. Please note this is an independent program, not produced or fact-checked by the Aetherius Society. Today, our guest is Matthew Melvin Koschke. Hello, Matthew.
Hi, Jack. Thank you so much for having me.
It's an honor to have you. I first heard of you through your magic PhD course.
Yeah. It started as an MA, now it's PhD focus. But it's, being done in conjunction with the Exeter magic MA program as well, magic and occult science. So exciting times, very unexpected, but things are building. And I can talk a little bit more about how we're building out that network as well for folks that are interested.
Yes.
We're also closely associated with RENSEP, the Research Network for the Study of Esoteric Practices. So we're very much emphasize the bringing together historians, anthropologists, and psychologists with actual occult practitioners who might be the same person. Actively funding these sort of scholarly practitioner partnerships. And that's certainly a larger theme that we would like to see happen in the world.
Yeah, well, I have a huge respect and gratitude to people like yourself who are trying to bring the occult into the mainstream, because the mainstream science is I mean, I'm sure it's must be a struggle for you talking to a brick wall sometimes if you once you go up against mainstream science or the materialistic world that we're in. Really respect you for doing this, and for young people especially, or to be able to go, is it a degree course or a post-degree course?
So it's a master's and now, a PhD, possibly. Again, we're still in the early stages of building it out, it is a full, graduate, postgraduate, I guess, in the UK, course. Ours is a two-year MA, a six-year PhD. The Exeter one is a one-year MA. We're looking to partner together to do a hybrid Exeter USC degree as well. But yeah, a lot of other things, fun things are in the works as well.
Yeah, you have a huge appetite for work.
No, I have a huge appetite for punishment. As you said, it's the brick wall is in, it's my own fault, right? I went for the most, marginal, which is early modern Islamic magic. Like, it's, yeah. It's everyone at every level, right? So from the history of science and technology standpoint, right? So I have a PhD in religious studies from Yale. I was told, we just do mysticism, Sufism is over here, has nothing to do with the West, nothing to do with science and technology or even philosophy. It's like a betrayal or rejection of real science. This is what we're taught. And that never was set right, but it wasn't until after I finished my my PhD that I realized, this is just mainstream history of science and technology for two-thirds of the human race. The Islamic world is massive, right? In the early modern period. So my big thing is reframing this massive archive on the occult sciences. I can explain what those are, within a history of science and technology discourse, right? Our narrative of the West is purely colonialist and completely counterfactual. It's completely anti-historical, but it does. It's a good myth to justify colonialism, obviously. But it is quite evil, in fact, because it deletes two-thirds of the human race from rationality, from science, and from technology.
I think you're a man after my own heart. Is that we don't look when we see an injustice or something, the job that needs doing that no one else wants to do. They just feel drawn towards that job.
Well, as a very strong Aquarian, a sort of Madden Sullivan Aquarius person, it's just kind of whatever, I gravitate to it. I also am like a failed monk, failed Orthodox monk. But anyway, I like to go for the stale things, I suppose, on the margins of society.
The underdogs, yeah.
Well, but what I did not realize, and this is basically my project, life's project, the thing that offends, that offends reviewers the most is probably the most productive avenue to road to hoe. and reliably, you know, just this, like, these emotional reactions you get from objective, you know, scholars, it's all quite emotional. It's all very, you know, magic can't exist. Therefore, it, like, Islamic magic can't exist. Therefore, it doesn't exist. This is not an art. This is not a objective argument. It's just a massive reality historically and to the present in the Islamic world, in the world generally. But the only way, as I argue, to understand the history of the West, to decolonize the history of the West, philosophy and science, from Plato and Aristotle and Pythagoras onward, you have to bring in the Islamic world, right? Because they do very similar, but also amazingly different, cooler, I find, things with Plato and Pythagoras that you don't get in the far West, Latin Christendom far West. So for example, Theosophy, right? I know this kind of, you know, the serious society comes out kind of that mix. The roots of Theosophy lie in early modern Islamic South Asia. The, you know, East-West occultism is a huge product of the Mughal Empire. And Theosophy is coming out of that mix under the rubric of British colonialism. But that East-West occultism thing is an Islamic invention. You know, so you can't know anything about the history of Theosophy, for example, without knowing the history of the Mughal Empire, and you can't know anything about the history of the Mughal Empire without the history of Platonism and Pythagoreanism. So I focus on Pythagoreanism in the early modern Islamic world, which has so far been almost completely unstudied, again, due to these, like, knee-jerk reactions that there can be no such thing as Persian Pythagoreanism, which includes the mathematization of the cosmos and talismans and magic and space travel, but and reincarnation, of reincarnationism, simply because the Greeks hate the Persians. So therefore, there is no, this massive phenomenon ceases to exist.
Yeah. Well, you know, but they say in this society, to educate someone, by definition, it has to be disruptive. There needs to be disruption to change, to get new information in. Just some thought that struck me, because like the masters that communicated through, that used Madame Blavatsky, were any of them Islamic? Because they're ascended masters. Before they ascended, were they their last incarnation? You know, if they came from that world,
right? So this is my main beef with Theosophy. I have, you know, amazing scholar friends, colleagues working on Theosophy in, you know, India during the sort of initial stages. And what's been, you know, shown is that consistently, the European actors, or the, you know, English actors, are highlighted, and their equal partners in India, who, you know, are Muslim or Hindu or Jain or whoever, are consistently downgraded, or, you know, they're a source, but they're not an actor in their own story, right? So the new pushes to show the East, you know, West-East balance. So, you know, again, but the problem with that is the process of British colonialism was about, and French colonialism as well, which results in the map of the modern Middle East, which is designed to be a disaster, which is, you know, that's what, you know, it's designed to be a horror show. It takes, again, the Middle East as a Cold War term really has to do with the excision of all the stuff in between, all the cartilage. Right? All the collagen, all the cartilage, all the tendons that actually link West and East. Oh, right. That's the Islamic world. So the Islamic world is completely put out of history. Mm-hmm. So you have this bizarre East-West, you know, yin-yang thing, West being masculine, obviously, and East being, the Orient being feminine. And Islam, which combines the, you know, is the marriage of the opposites, right? Like in the Alexandrian sense, marriage of East and West is Islam, right? From a very early period. So you have this weird dichotomy where the masculine is privileged over the, you know, West is privileged over the feminine East. And the whole Islamic thing in the middle is just disappeared. Yeah. So
Blavatsky, have you seen those pictures of, I think it was the Master KH and the Masters M from Theosophy? They look kind of, I mean, Madame Blavatsky didn't publicize them too much, but they were their dress and their big beards like you. I mean, do you think they came from that tradition, or?
No, absolutely. I mean, so this is, you know, one of the things I focused more on the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries, but extends to the 19th. But yeah, one of the biggest takeaways from recent research is that, and especially pernicious with the rise of Hindu nationalism and Hindutva right now, where Islam is only an alien accretion, an alien invasion in true Hindu India. It's all nonsense. It's all totally anti-historical and fascist and, you know, racist. But it has its roots in British Orientalism, right? And well, and I'm trained in the Orientalist tradition, right? In the German, French Orientalist tradition myself. So I know this rhetoric very well, which is that Islam is like this floating signifier that doesn't ever like actually get rooted in the earth anywhere other than the Middle East. So Blavatsky is coming out of, you know, like she's not an Oriental. I mean, she's an Orientalist, right? But as a, non-professional Orientalist, she doesn't know anything about Islam. She certainly doesn't know anything about the history of Islam in South Asia, right? So it's not her fault that she gravitates toward like the Sanskrit stuff, right? Cool. But like my early modern occultists, in Islamic South Asia are doing the same thing. They're the first to, they did the historic Sanskrit Persian translation movement that has the Upanishads translated into Persian for the first time, for example. And these are occultists doing this for good reasons that the theosophy seems to rhyme with quite well, except that theosophy gets rid of Islam, which makes it makes India into more of an ahistorical orient, if that makes sense, right? Like Islam has been in India for like 1,000 years, right? Christianity has been in North America for what, like 400 years? If you get rid of Islam, again, it's 2/3 of the human race, you get rid of any way to explain the rise of, well, occultism or even theosophy itself.
Yeah. But the ascended masters, I mean, they must have had a reason for, you know, forming it in that way. I mean, maybe the karmic balance or some sort of, you know, because theosophy is to unite all the religions, you know, that, I mean.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's just that Islam gets this, like, you know, because of the side, scholarship, it's like, maybe somehow it's not West, but it's not East either. It's the Middle East, whatever you want to call it. I mean, Sufism is big, and this is another beef I do have with theosophy. It's the more focus on mysticism rather than technology, right? My sources, early modern Persian Arabic sources in Iran, Central Asia, the Ottoman Empire, South Asia, are very clear that, you know, astrology, alchemy, obviously are technologies, but so is prayer, right? One of the most distinctive things is prayer is as a Pythagorean discipline based around the mantra, other ritual practices. Prayer is a Pythagorean technology. Again, you say, oh, the mantra has to come from, you know, India or wherever. Well, no, it actually comes from North Africa. This sort of rise of the mantra-based talismanic prayer practice from the 13th century to the present, really. It actually starts in the Mediterranean area in the Islamic world and migrates east, where it fuses beautifully, naturally, married beautifully and naturally with Vedic practice, with yoga, with all these things. So under the Mongol auspices, you have the translation of yoga treatises into Persian for the Mongols, right? But again, this is all this cartilage that gets cut out. Breath work, mantra stuff is not like this Eastern import into the West in that sense. It's a marriage of minds.
Was Gurdjieff, was he classed as an Islamic occultist?
Gurdjieff, no. I mean, he's not an Islamicist at all.
Did he come from North Africa? Where was the area that he did? Because he did I saw the film on him where they go, he's...
I don't know his biography very well.
Yeah, they should check out that movie of his. They did, biopic. Yeah, it was quite interesting. that was definitely set in a... Yeah, I have to check where that was. But do the Ascended Masters feature in Islamic occultism?
Absolutely. So Okay, so my work is the intersection of science and technology, the occult sciences in particular, but that includes everything from astrology and planetary ascent to prayer and like yoga, effectively. As it relates to empire and empire building in the post-Mongol period, the Mongols conquered, well, the world, right, all of Asia. And then things got super occult super quickly and remain so. And, you know, to and through the colonial period, including in Islamic South Asia. And the, it's really has to do with British chauvinism, that you have this 19th century anthropological armchair anthropology discourse of you know, evolution of humanity from magic to religion to science, to justify the civilization, you know, the mission civilisatrice, right, of the French, the civilizing mission of the superstitious natives, the savages, such that Christian missionaries, including, you know, American missionaries in the Middle East, consistently hammer away at Islam as the superstition of the natives because magic is everywhere, right? So the British are doing that to feel better about themselves in India. Obviously, you know, Blavatsky and these people, you know, are doing something else. But in the Islamic context, as occultism relates to empire in particular, it's predicated and the rise of occult, what I call occult philosopher kingship, is predicated on the theory, the political cosmic theory of Ibn Arabi. This, extremely. Probably one of the top five most influential people in the entire Western tradition. He's from Islamic Spain, and do the Reconquista. He goes, you know, east to Syria, to, you know, Konya and these places. And most of his disciples are going more to the Eastern Persian realm, from Egypt to basically the Pacific Ocean. And so massively, massively influential. And his whole thing is the hierarchy of saints as the rulers of the universe, right? And it's very, very cosmic, very planetary as well. Different saints and different prophets, especially, are associated with different planets, right? So his whole thing, it's kind of like Swedenborg in a way, but is much more political and much more imperial, which is that, you know, the true rulers of the world are these ascended, you know, you can call them ascended masters, but, you know, for him, they're, you know, saints, you know, prophets are always saints as well. But yeah, like literally the prophet saints inhabit the different planets, right? They're part of the planetary intelligence.
Wow. It's very cosmic. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's very cosmic. It's very planetary. It's very, astral, magical, theory of, the rulership, you know, political theory for, you know, the universe. And that becomes the basis for, early modern Islamic philosopher kingship theory or discourses, where you have all the, you know, many of the greatest rulers of the Islamic world, like Emperor Akbar in India, right? Like the greatest ruler of the 16th century. He has a talismanic body and is the supreme being. He's the Kwisatz Haderach, literally, you know, based on this theory of the Barbie of every age must have a pole, often a, you know, unknown person, that pulls the entire cosmos together, and they have deputies all going down this, like, it's like a pyramid hierarchy with the pole, the axis mundi at the, you know, at the top. The revolution in the 15th and especially 16th century is that kingship becomes sainthood through the use of magic and like talismanic magic, right? So you have Emperor Akbar is the supreme being, is a talismanic being, uniting East and West, Islam and Hinduism, like whatever you want to think about, heaven and earth, astrally traveling all the time. That's what a talisman is for. But he is the supreme being, and he is, you know, basically, if we want to translate it to, you know, theosophical terms, he is the supreme ascended master in that generation. Also, his influence will endure for the next 1,000 years. So it's a millennial discourse as well. So he's the supreme, you know, ascended master for the next millennium. Much like I don't know, Jesus was, you know, originally another ascended master. So it's Piscean age. Messianic age or Piscean age, exactly. So he's kicking off, not exactly the age of Aquarius, but it's a new dispensation, right? Whereby any other saints that come out of this line are in that mold, the Akbarian mode, which is, again, Islamic, Indic, talismanic, and so on. So, yeah, I have to think more about it, the ascended master thing. It's the basis of Islamic political theory in the early modern period.
There you go, yeah.
But with magic, with hardcore magic as technology, right?
Yeah,
so we're talking about these ascended masters. What are they doing on this planet? Which is why I found, reading through Yale stuff recently, there's a huge emphasis on building talismanic cities. So the body is talisman. So this is for building empire, but for healing society, right? So the creation of talismanic cities for physical healing, physical and mental healing. The creation of talismanic buildings as spaceships, literally buildings that are meant to eject, get you out of your body so you can ascend the planetary spheres, right? This is the only way to do, Islamic philosophy, not the only way, but the best, most mainstream way of doing Islamic philosophy, which is Platonic and Pythagorean, is very much about out-of-body philosophy. Through ritual magic rituals of planetary ascent, whereby you incarnate all the planetary intelligences as you ascend to the divine throne beyond the solar system. They're also very heliocentric because they're Pythagorean, the central fire. Basically you have to incarnate all the planets, and they built the Taj Mahal as a spaceship. The city of Isfahan as the new self of the capital is a talismanic city that is terraforming it's landscape as talisman as well. Sacred mountains, Mountains of Solomon and so on, that actually transform you physically and spiritually, into a perfect being, into a saint. This is something I've come to recently, and I teach plenty of ufology in my magic courses. These things are designed as spaceships in modern parlance, to get you to, they're ejector seats to throw you up into, space.
I've heard that said about the pyramids as well, that they were originally designed for that, or power transference as well. Yeah. So it's interesting what you said about incarnating through the planets as well. That's exactly what it says in the Nine Freedoms, which is, after you've gone through the initiation of ascension, then you have to go through all the classrooms on Earth. All the classrooms in the solar system, and work your way through them, learning different things in different classrooms. Because, as they say in, as Dr. King asked when he was as a young child, he was taught all the other planets are uninhabited. He said as a young child, a little boy, what are they there for then? Why did God make them? I mean, they're just inhabited at a different frequency. And we're at a very low frequency, so when we go there, we don't see anyone. But when we raise our consciousness, we would see people. So yeah, that really, really ties in. And I've heard it said in the same thing. We've spoken to Indian scholars, and if you go back through their teachings, it's all encoded language, but it also has this cosmic, multidimensional, interplanetary aspect, which has all been lost by. So it's scholars like yourself who are doing amazing work to uncover all of that.
No, yeah, thank you. I mean, the thing is the early modern Islamic cosmology is posits a cosmos that is extremely busy and packed with intelligence, right? It's all, I play around the term with Islamic animism, because this is one of the main polemical, weapons used by Christian missionaries in the Middle East, is to dismiss Islam as animism, because it's also superstitious and magical, and it believes in a living cosmos, blah, blah, blah. I mean, this is kind of the default human, you know, cultural default. But yeah, the like one of the philosophers I work on, Mir Damod, around the turn of the 17th century, one of the people responsible for, as a Pythagorean Platonic philosopher, inspiring the design of Isfahan, the capital of the Safavid Empire, as a talismanic city meant to create saints, literally by healing bodies, but also elevating, you know, spirits. Just by walking down the central boulevard from the palace to Mount Solomon, right? Or the seat, you know, seat of Solomon, or the throne of Solomon up on the mountain. So like it's, you go across the river of life and you become you enter the necropolis of saints and imams, and then you ascend to the throne of Solomon and you become a saint just by walking the geography of Isfahan. Anyway, so Mir Damod, sorry, this is all very in the weeds, but
great.
I published extensively on this. But yeah, Mir Damod, a philosopher that everyone should have heard of, like Spinoza, but no one has heard of Mir Damod, even though he's one of the most important early modern philosophers in the entire Western tradition. But also, unlike Spinoza, materially changes the built environments according to this, you know, Platonic Pythagorean philosophy of talismanic ascent. Talismanic ascent. Anyway, so Mir Damod says he has these out-of-body experiences all the time through mantra practice, obviously, breathing and mantra practices. This is just what you do, right? It's not Indic. I mean, it's Indic, but it's like Mediterranean, it's India, right? And it's a wonderful marriage. Anyway, so he does these, you know, mantra practices, and he has these out-of-body experiences. And one of the most remarkable, passages, he talks about, you know, once you get out of your body, it's incredibly busy up there. Incredibly busy, right? It's just throngs of every being you can possibly imagine. And he says, everything that, you know, every being that can exist, and even all the beings that can't exist, are there. Right, so like it's overwhelming. It's a very traumatic experience to actually go through the universe without, you know, ascend through the cosmos, through the planetary spheres, without. In other words, it's good that we are deadened to the.
It's like Men in Black. I think there's a lot of truth in that film.
Yeah, Men in Black, exactly. So like the point is, if we didn't have, we weren't shut down, kind of like the brain is this massive filter anyway, we would be so overwhelmed. Everyone go instantly insane. There's no way for our brains to process this amount of beingness, right? So, anyway, but yeah, so he calls it the capital of being, where even everything that can exist and everything that can't or will never exist, it is there.
Yeah.
So it's overwhelming, it's terrifying, it's traumatic, but it's also, when you get back into the body, you feel like, you know, as he says, he's not a Gnostic thinker, but he says, coming back into your body from one of these space, you know, flights is extremely depressing. It's traumatic up there, but like you're back in your body, it's like now you're all alone.
Well, there's so much I want to digest and talk to you about that. I think we have to do a whole series. I mean, that idea of, you know, because there's all these sciences on the other worlds that, you know, like, you see how fast humanity is evolving. We're already talking, you know, cloning sheep and doing things like that, and you know, they're engineering that. And so imagine if you extrapolate that in a million years, what we'd be doing. And just some of the sciences like they must have on other worlds were like the crystals and the spaceships like 10,000 miles long, whatever. And so sciences like that, because I imagine, because do you go back to like the civilization of Atlantis and Lemurius? I mean, are these eight? Because we're taught one of the lies in I had Graham Hancock on my other podcast, and you know, he's saying, you know, the civilization of Atlantis and things like this, saying that civilization is way older than we think. You know, it could be Atlantis could be 10,000, but I think in our teachings we're told that Atlantis is even like a million years ago or something like that. So civilization stretches back eons. Does that also tie in with your Islamic studies?
Absolutely. And again, coming to India, right? Islamic India, you know, especially under the Mughal Empire, the Indo-Timurid Empire, in the West, keep in mind the West includes Islam. You know, Islam is the, in terms of population, in terms of textual and cultural primitivity, Islam is the majority West in terms of the reception of Plato, Aristotle, Pythagoras, and also the Abrahamic tradition, right? The Quran is an appendix to the Bible. It's just what that's it self-identifies as an appendix to the Bible. So I define the West as the Hellenic Abrahamic dialectic. And it goes in different ways, and different emphases are made in various parts. So you can use Plato, like one of the most distinctive things that happens in the Islamic world that does not happen in the Latinate Christian far West is the much more aggressive use of Pythagoras to disprove Aristotelian physics, which is very interesting. And again, like it's, you know, I won't get into the details, but suffice it to say that when you have Muslim, you know, occult philosophers, Platonists and Pythagoreans from Iran, Iran and the Iranian diaspora, going to India and translating from Sanskrit to Persian, like the Arabic to Latin translation movement is hailed, oh, this is the beginning of, you know, the West and the Renaissance. Well, yeah, but like the Sanskrit to Persian translation movement was equally important for constructing the West. I mean, theosophy is a much later, you know, like footnote in a way to that initial Sanskrit to Persian translation movement, although it doesn't really, it's only beginning to get historians working on it. That's all to say, once you have this Sanskrit to Persian translation movement and a lot of like treatises on the Upanishads, but also lots of treatises on yoga translated into Persian as well, you get this debate in this, you know, between like West and East, right? The Islamo-Jewish Christian Abrahamic default of young Earth creationism, right? Which I grew up evangelical, right? Which is like a standard issue, right? You get 6,000 years and kablooey, bam, no more. Like the entire universe is a trap and a trick, right? And then, you know, hell is eternal, obviously. But then these guys are going to India, they're talking to, you know, yogis and, you know, they're all occultists. And alchemists and you know astrologers as well, it becomes possible in the Islamic context using Pythagoras to disprove, right? Like Plato as well. Like the default Greek position is the eternity of the world, right? So there's no beginning; it's all an eternal emanation of the One, which is the Pythagorean position. And the One is light and it's letter and it's number. I mean, it's number and then it becomes letter. And then language is the key to reality. Mathematical language is the key to reality. And if you think in astrological terms, you're also thinking in infinite cycles, right? There's no beginning to astrology. I mean, what the hell is going on, right? So like this cyclicist. Vision, so it's the sort of Western astrology, Ptolemaic Greek, with Pythagoras and Plato, meets through the intermediary of Muslim cultists in India from Iran with, you know, the Mahabharata, the Ramayana, the whole Vedic thing, the whole Upanishad, whole Vedic cosmology. Which, you know, is not necessarily the eternity of the world, but the extreme antiquity of the world, right? Deep, deep, deep history. The world is millions of years old, obviously, right? This is something that really offends all the Jesuits at the Mughal court, for example. And they have like these big debates, and Emperor Akbar stages these religious debates between representatives of different, you know, religions, you know, Zoroastrians and Jesuits and, you know, Sunni and Shi'i Muslims and, you know, rabbis and all this stuff. And so a lot of the Western folks, Muslim, Jewish and Christian, they're like pushing for this like young Earth creationism. And Akbar just makes so much fun of them. It's hilarious. They're like, dude, the Earth is obviously millions of years old. Like, have you seen the Vedic the Indic scriptures? Have you seen astrology much, right? So this cyclicalism, the occultism, and the Pythagoreanism that I work on, and it's also underwrites a reincarnationism, right, in the Islamic context before you go to India, right, because of Pythagoras and Plato. I mean, they're both reincarnationists, right? And we also get Atlantis from Plato as well. He says it's 30,000 years old, not a million, but so we get, you know, Plato and Pythagoras going east through occultism and interfacing with old Earth theories in India in order to stick it to the more Mediterranean young Earth creationists. Posits the Earth is at least millions of years old and might be eternal.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's great to see these things corroborated with these traditions. It gives you so much more validation and perspective. And also, you mentioned about the ufology that you teach, because when we look at Christianity, we have we have stars moving slowly across the sky and then stopping in front of a stable. I mean, that sounds pretty much ufology. We've got people moving around in clouds, all sorts of. Jesus said he was from the brighter morning star, which is the Venus. So, Islamic occultism also a good tradition of ufology?
So, what now goes by the name of ufology, right? It's also, Jacques Vallée is, the classic authority on these matters, obviously, but it intersects with jinn, jinnology, right? So the jinn, genies, right? Genie in the lamp. So there's a lot of Islamic magic is focused on jinn, right? Apparitions and control, but like jinn and angels, sometimes demons, but like mainly jinn and angels are the basis for a lot of early modern talisman technology as well. Planets, angels, and angels are often associated with the planets as their intelligences. And then jinn, so like celestial and then terrestrial. So jinn are much more like UFOs in, Earth, sky, and space, right?
We have multi realms on this Earth. There's many realms of existence.
There's many realms of existence, and different, species have different powers, right? So jinn are, carbon based, but like jinn are very, very UFO-y, right? So UFOs, as we all know, are physical and also non-physical at the same time, right? They leave like burn marks, but then you can't like. But then you see dead relatives in Bigfoot, when you're abducted by aliens, like you're hanging out in the mothership and like your dead relatives and Bigfoot is sitting right there. Like, what is going on here? I get a lot of this stuff, obviously, from Jacques Vallée, but also Jeff Kripal, his book was Whitley Strieber, Supernatural, right? The UFO phenomenon has something to do with death. Right. But it's still physical, right? There's still physical things that are going on. There's craft that are doing things and then breaking the law of the physics, as we know now. There are military applications and military. One of the most interesting things that resonates with my material is the fact that the UFOs distinguish between military and civilian aircraft. Right. That's kind of, Vallée was, recent interview was talking about, that's, actually quite disturbing. We're not talking about Independence Day, right? We're talking more about Arrival, actually, which is my favorite UFO movie. Effectively, jinn have the same sort of capacity to, like Bigfoot, come in and out of what we consider physical carbon-based reality, although they are made of smoke. So they're carbon based as well, but they have this sort of, fairy like quality. They can code, phase shift. They have their civilizations, they have their cities and civilizations like at the bottom of the ocean or in the middle of the Sahara or, the middle of the desert. So they don't like to hang out with us too much and they, but they do overlap and they can pop into our reality and out, as they wish, whereas the magician, wishes. And more importantly, they're different, all different sort of cultures and nations and, religions, like some are Muslim.
Could this be the Devic kingdom? Is that the Devas, like the fairies and the...
Yeah, jinn, deva, those very, devas, jinn, all that stuff. It's all like mixed together, UFOs, aliens. There are many different species, many different sort of religions and cultures, like I said. Some are Muslim, some are, Christian, some are Jewish, some are Hindu, like it doesn't really matter. They're just doing their own thing. And sometimes they intersect, and where they most often intersect is through magic and through military operations. there's a very strong military component. Like Jinn magic is important for, you know, assassinating your enemy, right, on the battlefield. So this interesting thing, like so there's warlike, you know, Jinn nations and pacifist Jinn nations. So the idea is to get the king of the Jinn on your side to, you know, to do when you go into battle. Like it's, you know, it's very Lord of the Rings, I suppose,
it
right?
It is very.
You know, like it's like Jinn can, because Jinn can, like UFOs, like go in and out of physical reality and break the laws of apparent laws of physics. So that you can imagine the military applications of that as well. So yeah, I mean,
but where can people read about that then? I mean, we're almost out of time, but so much more I wanted to ask you about. Where can people read about things like that, or your books? Where can people? Because people want, after hearing you speak now, I mean, many people want to get stuck in. Like, what's the best way?
Yeah. I mean, the research on this, you know, especially Jinn interfacing with ufology is very new. Folks like Dunja Rashic, Emily Seelove at Exeter, my colleague and partner at University of Exeter, you know, very much works on these types of things. There's a number of junior scholars beginning to work on it, but there's no one place to. This is how I teach it, right?
Yeah,
seeing it together from different places, you know, so
holding all the pieces together, your huge archives and your, yeah, you've got massive, so much.
To there's only, well, there's only a few of us working on it too, right? Yeah. It's identity, right? So, yeah, basically the, for anyone interested, you know, whenever you look for UFOs and Bigfoot and, you know, fairy lore, also include Jinn, and the Jinn, you know, I wouldn't say fairies and Jinn are the same entity, obviously, because there's too much variation. But in terms of the physical behavior and characteristics, including military applications, I would say Jinn are closest to the whole phenomenon now, especially from the, you know, imperial, you know, state interest perspective. But yeah, I mean, so speaking of Jinn as well, you know, I know we're almost out of time, but so talisman. This is kind of the central thing that
keep going back to that. Yeah, yeah.
What is a talisman? How can a human body be a talisman? Why is an ascended master's body by definition a talisman?
Yeah.
Right? What is a talisman? It is a machine. It's a, you know, like you guys have the batteries, right? Storing spiritual power. It is a machine. It's a device made of metals, right? You know, gold, silver, lead, steel, whatever. That you know, can put somewhere, wear on your body, right? It is a machine, a metal mathematical, you know, astral.
Radionics, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it's infused, like, you know, you have to activate it with your own intention and your own ritual practice with various mantras that are encoded in the talisman. Again, early modern Pythagorean talismans in the Islamic world are very different from ancient talismans, which are much simpler. The classic talisman in early modern Islamic world is based around a magic square, which harnesses a planetary intelligence and the angels and the jinn that serve that planetary intelligence. So it harnesses mathematically, everything celestial is mathematical, right? Basic Pythagoreanism. And so it harnesses both your intention, but also the planetary intention, and like there's actors. It's not just you. You're entering into a complicated hierarchical relationship with planets, angel, and jinn to get things done, whether for, you know, martial or Venusian purposes in love and war and peace. But building empire is very important to understand. It is a machine for marrying celestial influences to terrestrial bodies, right? So the talisman is as a Pythagorean machine for guaranteeing answers to prayer every single time, whether for medical purposes or for military purposes or for economic purposes. It doesn't matter. Like it's a machine. It doesn't matter how you use it. And it's also, you know, it can be built into the human body, but also into the structure of architecture, right? The structure, the built environment. So talisman has this master category, celestial, terrestrial, you know, marriage of celestial influences to terrestrial, you know, bodies. but it also is that thing that pops you out of your physical body and allows you to, you know, explore, well, the planetary experience personally, and thereby imitating prophets like the Prophet Muhammad himself, or Jesus, right? Ascended masters who, well, literally ascend through the planets, right? This is what ascent is in Platonic philosophy, in Pythagorean philosophy, by definition. So it's very ancient, very Western. But I argue that it becomes, you know, completely systematized in a way that never is not paralleled in the far Western Christian Latin context, which is the only context to study. Like, the Byzantines have been excluded as well. But, like, you know, by the 16th century, you have talismans as, well, you know, basically Silicon Valley, right? This, it's computing technology as well. It's psychic spying, right? It's Googling, it's psychic spying. All of these different technologies are coming together. And, you know, we can, it's not the only technology, but for our purposes here, think about a talisman as making your, not your body, well, making your body into medicine, right? An alchemical body, but also into a space vehicle, right? Whether physically or in the built environment.
It really ties in so well with, I mean, when Dr. King saw the Masters, Space Masters, they wear a belt with crystals in it, you know, they, which enhance their abilities. And we're told that the human body is basically a radionic machine, you know, for using spiritual energy. And
This is the thing. So, like, I'd be curious. Sorry to interrupt you. How does he talk about this sort of marriage of science and religion through magic?
Well, they say the Master Jesus said that religion, science without religion, is like the soulless wanderer of the night.
Oh, nice, beautiful.
Yeah, they must. Well,
all of my sources would agree.
Yeah, they have to. You have to unite again. This is just the. We're going through a dark phase, and I mean, I heard a podcast the other day. Jacques Vallée has in his library. He has many books. He has lots of bookcases on angels, and lots of bookcases on fallen angels, because you can't have one without the other. So there's the ascended masters, but there's the descended masters from the lower astral realms, and all the libraries, the mess we're in is all because of this. We're being ruled by a small handful of people, and we're destroying, you know, we, so that's why we need to unite the light. We need to unite all these teachings. We need to take back so that we can, you know, stop pissing around here with all this shit that's going on, and just let ourselves be played like pawns by these dark masters. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just not an accident that I always tell my students, I'm teaching the history of science and tech, you know, intro class right now. So I always tell my students, well, what do you expect when you base your entire, you know, civilization on oil, which is like really old, like, you know, dead things, you know, so, you know, photosynthesis, it was like the most concentrated form of, you know, light into darkness, I suppose. It packs a punch. It definitely packs a punch, but also completely fucks up the entire physical and mental environments, right? So it's really, we have a necromantic culture. And, you know, so in a way, it's like, you know, inevitable, right? If you base your entire thing on really old dead stuff.
That's a good way to look at it, You get you deserve. You get the leaders you deserve. You get, it's all karma, basically.
Right. So, like, maybe don't think so much about death. Like, think about life as well as, like, really old dead things. That would be cool. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's a beautiful note to end on. So your website, or if people want to do the course, I mean, if they're that at that level already, how can people follow you? What's the best way to keep in touch?
Right. So we don't have we're working on the one hub to bring all these elements together. It'll be at the magicseminar.org. Basically just Google, speaking of Googling, right, as an imperial, you know, sort of occult technology, just Google, Magic USC. But just send me an email. Once we have a website up and running, and, you know, hopefully next month, it'll be easier. But we finished recruitment for this year, so Admissions will be open again in the fall for our program, again, 2-year MA or 6-year PhD. And admissions are closed for Exeter for the fall. They're completely full, like wildly successful.
Brilliant.
So wildly successful there as well. So next fall would be the first opportunity for anyone interested. In the meantime, we'll have more information. We'll have a single website so anyone can go. But like in the meantime, the Exeter, just do Exeter Magic. It comes up.
Okay.
Rensep.org, R-E-N-S-E-P. Where I'm on the scientific committee with folks like Dean Radin. He's constructed little, boxes to do sigil magic testing in the lab. This is going on. So check out his magictest.com. I think it's there. If anyone wants to take part of his sigil magic experience with little black boxes. Dean Radin is kind of the ideal, of where we like to go, bring parapsychologists with, together with historians and anthropologists and psychologists. So check out rensep.org, become a member. It has a whole forum and lots of fellowship opportunities, grant opportunities, these types of things. For example, if you like UFOs, there's a small grant for $5,000 to go hang out at Rice University, where Jeff Kripal is based, right? To work on work in the archives of the impossible for a month. Why not?
Sounds good.
Yeah, it's like, it's here, $5,000 to go look at the UFO. Look at the UFOs. Like, what else do you want? So we have fun projects like that. We are in the, we're also recruiting donors at this point. So we're looking to expand. If anyone wants to take part in these programs, we're constructing this sort of larger network between USC, Exeter, Amsterdam, Rice, Rensep, Schwepp as well, the Secret History of Western Esotericism podcast, Earl Fontenelle. We're envisioning as this transatlantic network for the weird and the occult and the esoteric, but also, practitioner, like it's not practitioner, it's not hostile to practitioners in the way that it may have been until now.
Wow. Gosh, you're so busy. I think I'm just so glad I got an hour of your time. I really appreciate you being so generous with your time.
No, thank you for this audience opportunity to speak with you and to this audience. Anyone who just would like to be involved, I think we have many values in common.
Definitely. Thanks, Matt. I'll share it with everyone. And if somebody wants to learn more about the Aetherius Society, they can go to aetherius.org. Thank you.
Thank you much.